Good morning. Welcome here once again, especially to anybody who considers themselves a visitor. Welcome here. Before we hurry on too far, let's ask the Lord for his blessing upon this time. Bow with me, please. Dearest Lord and Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the privilege of being able to call you Father. The access that we have through prayer, the confidence that we can have in our faith, and the ability that that gives us to come before your throne of grace, to find grace and mercy in our times of need. We thank you for your all-sufficient word. We thank you that in it we find all that we need to know how to live and to know how we are enabled to live, and to know all that you have provided for us in order for us to live this life. And I pray that as we consider all these bountiful graces that you have given us, whether that be even something like the church, where week by week we can come in and be refreshed and be encouraged and be challenged, and to see others who are about the day by day following after your will, I thank you so much that you don't leave us to ourselves. And even in the Word, that you don't leave us to our own good ideas, but that you continually are correcting and growing, that you are sanctifying us. That you don't intend us just to rest on the laurels of our justification, that we have been saved, but that you expect us to continue to grow, and more than just expect us to do that in our own strength, that you grant us all that we need in order to be able to pursue that path. And so I pray, Lord, this morning, as we reconsider a fairly common text, as we think of a passage that we've all read and read over, that it would strike us with a freshness, an available application that we may not have seen before. And I pray that the words that I have prepared would be of benefit, that they would edify, but above all of that, that they would be genuine and true, and that they would come from you, and that they would clearly so be your word explained as you would have it explained. Lord, would you be honored above all else with my effort this morning. In your holy name we pray. Amen. We're all aware of the privilege, the gift, the blessing it is to be a parent. And there's something that's overwhelmingly special for the first time. Not that every child isn't special, but the first time comes with all the stuff that the parents have to think through that they haven't had to think through before. There's this 9 months of anticipation where mom and dad must deal with a new reality that seems to every day just be more shocking and more abrupt than it was the day before when you thought about it. Mom deals with this growing baby inside of her as this becomes just more and more real, that this is a person, that this is, it's not just something that could happen, it's a person. And she starts thinking what all this means while externally she starts preparing. Suddenly she wants to repaint, or at least my wife did, or she wants to organize everything again, or at least my wife did. She starts making the house ready for baby, right? I hear that's a common thing for moms to do. Dad spends this time trying to take care of mom while thinking about what this all means for him, what this requires of him, both in responsibility and ability. What do we know about kids at that point? Sure, we've hung out with kids, but now, like, what is this expected of me? What do I got to do? How to provide as well as how to raise this child? What our measure is of how we, like, what are we expecting out of our, like, what do we want to raise them unto? Like, what's the image? Like, there's all these things that parents think about. Also being a provider and providing safety for this child and providing enough for the family. In the end, it's this incredible mishmash of being concerned about things and then being encouraged about things. And then in the end, the incredible joy of being able, looking forward to bring this new person that you'll enter into your life. And One of the manifestations of this whole time is preparing a new nursery. Parents pick out paint colors, they buy some new furniture, they lovingly put together this space for this new baby. And they do that with that baby in mind. This person's coming, you know, and they get it all ready. Over the last while, as we've made our way through Genesis chapter 1, we have come alongside the Israelites as they have learned about their God. As this kind of unfathomable, I mean, we know he's unfathomable, but thinking of it from the Israelites' perspective, where the supernatural was not an uncommon topic, suddenly they meet this God who isn't measurable like the other gods. You know, the Egyptians would have had a god of death or a god of the river or a god of farmland, right? Like, he's very, very boundary-oriented. And then suddenly we have this God who brought them out of the land of Egypt, who's essentially done everything. How do you wrap your head around that? And so we've come alongside with them as they're learning about this God and how this God has cared for them even before they knew about him or knew him well. They knew maybe about him, but that they knew much about him. They didn't know much about his qualities or who he was or what he wanted. God has shown himself to them through creation, through this story or this narrative. Story is the wrong word because it carries with it fiction, that concept. So I hesitate to use that word, but it's the retelling of an event that God is doing here. And he undermines all the myths and tales that they would have been used to. That would have formed their view of the supernatural. And in this telling, he not only is telling them how things happen, but he is telling them these wonderful truths about himself and what it means to be his people. More than just being apologetic in nature, Genesis 1 proves itself to be devotional. And as it must have led the Israelites to praise this God, their God, it leads us now who are reading with the whole of the Bible in mind to a greater and greater appreciation of him. And hopefully it increases or it grows our love and our worship of him. Like the parents who lovingly prepare the nursery for their coming baby, so till now we have seen God prepare a place for his beloved people, intimately providing all that they will need, not only to have a functional life. It's not just, look, there's a bed and there's a roof and there's food. You're fine. It's with care. It's a beautiful space. It's a comfortable space. It's way above what we would need. It's more than just a necessary space, but it is a place wherein we can thrive. And we find ourselves at the tail end of the sixth day, at the pinnacle of God's creation, the creation of man, the one for whom he made everything. In stark contrast to the zeitgeist or the thinking of our day, man is not created for earth, but earth is created for man. And man is not created for himself as a mean to his own ends, as the highest end of his own glory, but rather man is created for God. Not to fill some need, but to worship him, to bring him glory. And today we see God reveal to us in 3 points his purpose for man. And man's place in his creation, what that purpose says about his place. How can we ever understand who we are if we don't understand what we were made for? How can we understand what we're supposed to be about if we don't understand the intention that God had for us? And that's the question our text looks to answer. But before we get too much further, let's read the text. Genesis chapter 1. Verses 26 to 31. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, so that they will have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that creeps on the earth." Then God said, "Behold, I have given to you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has the fruit of the tree yielding seed, it shall be food for you.
and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that creeps on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. We have seen God make everything simply by the power of his word. He spoke, and it came into existence. First, the foundations. Then he gave those foundations a purpose by making a space. Then he filled that space with all the plants and the animals, with the sun, moon, and stars. God has been progressively building and making a place that his final creation can live. He is making a space in which they can properly put him on display. God has essentially built a theater, and now he is making the actors who will display his glory. I don't know about you, but growing up in the church, I've had a difficult time making a proper image of God in my mind. Not something visual, but understanding him in his scope of what he says about himself, to worship him, to pray to him rightfully. From a child onwards, I've always kind of understood God as being domineering and strict. And of course, it's justifiably so. I'm not saying that in a bitter tone. It makes sense. If he can see every little sin that I commit, if he can see every little moment of my life, of how often and how frequently I fall short of the standard he calls me to, how could he ever be anything but disappointed and unhappy with me? It took me getting older to realize that God understands that we are frail and that we are made of dust, and that if he could love us while we were enemies, how much more must he love us now that we are his people? And I think it would have been a similar struggle for the Israelites trying to comprehend this God, coming from a world of polytheism where there are many gods, each of which is fickle and quick-tempered. One moment they are kind and loving, and in a heartbeat they are angry and destructive, to a God who is not like us, to a God who has chosen them, who has put his love upon them, not because they were worthy, but because he decided to. Not because they were somehow more lovely than their neighboring nations, but because he decided to. It must have been difficult to rationalize, to come to terms with. And so God here, in his opening chapter, explains why he made them, why he made this beautiful and wondrous world for them, and what it means that they have been chosen by God, what it means or what it is that he wants them to accomplish with their lives. Which brings us to verse 26, in which we find our first point, which I have titled Purpose in Resemblance. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." And I mean, we could wrap up in this verse 27 as well, where God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. But there's something important I want us to look at in the second half of verse 26, which is why I stop us here. Immediately we see God here deviate from his original pattern. Till now he has made everything by simply speaking. God says, "Let there be," and there is. Now God says something different. "Let us make." Not that in some way God didn't make the rest of creation. He did. We see that in Genesis 1:7, so God made the expanse. In verse 16, so God made the two great lights. And in verse 25, God made the beasts of the earth. But we ought to notice the special nature of what God is doing with mankind. Here and here alone, we see God do so much more than just say, "Let there be mankind." But rather, he shows the intimacy with which he made mankind, to show the special nature of what he was making. And this points to mankind's purpose, because God doesn't just say, "Let us make man," and leave it at that, but rather God says, "Let us make man in our image. Let us make man in our, or according to, our likeness." As per usual, with every part of the Bible, especially in Genesis, there are plenty of parties that are willing to disagree with what is the common reading or the general understanding of this text. And you'll always find people on every side of every passage of what it could mean. But there is a clear and understood purpose for the way things are written, and it's that original understanding that we're striving after. And that's, again, what we see here in this plural language. We have seen how the God that is being used in this text, that word is that word Elohim, the plural form of God. And then there's these us's and ours. So we clearly see God making a point. If we then realize that God is revealing himself to Israel, we see quite clearly that this is intentionally Trinitarian language. Yes, we are reading backwards from a New Testament perspective. I don't think we can actually stop doing that. We've been indoctrinated, for lack of a better word, with the whole of the Bible. And so we have a bias that we're reading the whole Bible backwards when we read the Old Testament. But let's say you didn't. So take a minute to try and think you only had Genesis chapter 1. What would you do with all of this plural language coming from a nation of polytheism, understanding that there is this one God who is the God of your fathers, and then suddenly he's talking about himself in plural form, and he's saying us's and ours, let us make them in our image. What would you do with that? You must be asking questions. What is this God like? How can he do that? So it doesn't mean that they wouldn't have understood what Moses said with all of this plural language. I think there's a very real way in which God intended them to understand what he was saying about himself. And I think it's often the arrogance of our generation, as it is with every new generation, to think that they know more than the previous generation did, simply because they've come later. It's easy to look at his history as if they were buffoons, but we should be clear, it is because of them, because of their blessed intellect and hard work, that we know a lot of what we do. More often than not, they were far more intelligent than we are in every way, and God used them to develop much of the doctrine that we understand now. But regardless of all of that, our text makes it clear that this plural God represented himself in a singular manner, not as a pantheon making many different species all in an image of God, but making many different species, and only one of them bears the image of God. This plural God made a singular species as his image bearer, which is incredible for so many reasons. One major part of which is to show that he is this singular God. But another major part, likely even a primary part of what God is doing, is describing to the Israelites their purpose through his retelling of their origins. We have to kind of understand or put ourselves in their shoes. The Israelites would have had a very prominent awareness of death. People would die often and in many ways, whether in accidents or sickness or war, as well as the amount of animals that would be slaughtered in an average day or someone's life, whether that's for food or for sacrifice, right? Sacrifices were a part of many different religions. The Israelites would have understood that there isn't actually all that many physical differences between us and animals. Sure, we walk on two legs versus on four, but we all have heads and hearts, stomachs, organs, limbs, and blood. It isn't like our looks are what sets us apart as the image of God. In fact, it's thinking like that that makes it difficult for us to argue against those that say that we come from monkeys. After all, they have hands and feet and they have, you know, in fact, they have all the parts we do. And I mean, they've got those faces. Like, how can you really say that we don't look like they do? You see, we must have evolved from animals. We weren't created like the Bible says. It all just comes from a misunderstanding, right? When the misunderstanding lies in what it means to be an image of God. Image is a word in the Hebrew meaning something that is carved. So like a statue that is made of something, there will be striking similarities. But in the end, it is a dim reflection at best, so much more so when we talk about being the image of God. This word isn't used often in the Bible, and generally when it is used, it refers to idols. This matters because we have to understand that not all sculptures were forbidden, right? So if this image of God was such a priority and it means something to be carved, we can make that connection that sculptures then would be kind of a touchy subject. They ought to be forbidden. But we have to see that it isn't the carving that's the issue. It's specifically anything that is in the image of God that is forbidden. Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 to 6, it says, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth, beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments." So we're seeing that not every sculpture is forbidden. When God commanded the making of the ark for the tabernacle, for example, he commanded that two statues be made. Exodus 25, 17 to 20. "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubit wide. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Make them of hammered work. At the 2 ends of the mercy seat, make 1 cherub at one end and 1 cherub at the other end. From 1 piece you shall make the mercy seat with the cherubim at its 2 ends. The cherubim shall have their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings, with their faces towards one another. The faces of the cherubim are to be towards the mercy seat." Right? So we're seeing that sculptures aren't the thing that are bad, but it is rather images, things that are carved or made to represent or to look like God or to be a God in replacement of the real God. Because in the end, all images will fall short. Whether they are of God or a God in and of themselves, they cannot do what they were made to do. If somebody sets out to make an image of God, to take everything that the Bible says, and then they want to make a painting or a statue or something, this will represent God. Everything will fall short. They cannot encompass what God is. Or if they just make an image that they consider God, so they make an idol. What does the Bible tell us about idols? They can't breathe, they can't talk, they can't walk, they can't. How do we expect them to answer our prayer? Right? It's the height of foolishness. And so, imagery will always fall short when it comes to representing God. And we see an example of this when the Israelites made the golden calf. And so it's pretty easy to scoff at the idea that a cow would be what the Israelites would pick to worship. But it's not as ridiculous as you may think. It was an important part of their lives as far as a burden animal, being able to be strong. You could feed a lot of people from one of them. There was a lot of benefit to these animals as a provisionary animal. And so they want a God that provides for them. Here is a simple image for them to draw from. But in the end, the issue is not that they made an image of a calf, but rather that they are worshiping this calf as God. This image can't do anything, and yet they worship this image as God, right? Therein lies the blasphemy. The best understanding of what image means is maybe found in a little further in Genesis, in chapter 5, verse 3, where Seth is born. And it says there, "When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth." Before Adam, man was made in the image of God. After Adam, man is made in the image of Adam. Not because we all look like Adam, but what do we inherit from Adam that before we received from God? Right? And it's our nature. Now we get a sin nature. Before Adam sinned, man didn't have a sin nature. They were innocent. They were pure, truly in the image of God. After Adam, we have sin, a fallen and depraved nature that we are born with. We carry the image of our Father, and it is only through the intervention of the second Adam, namely Jesus Christ, that we are restored to the image of God. This is not to say that unbelievers don't carry the image of God. All mankind still does. But it is tarnished and broken. The image that an unbeliever carries doesn't reflect the one whom it was originally designed to reflect. It's like taking a beautiful statue of your beloved and covering it in garbage and filth and paint and oil and grease and nastiness, the nastiest things you can think of, and then saying, see, that's her. Well, clearly not, right? There's nothing you could draw from that image that would describe your beloved. And it's only after painstakingly cleaning and gently repairing the statue that once again it will reflect the wonder of its original intent. Same with us. We all bear the image of God, but we don't all equally reflect the God whom we represent. We still do, but it's covered and tarnished by the fall, by sin. Same deal with the word likeness. Hebrew, again, is a poetic language, and repetition is a very important part of that. It shows emphasis and importance, and that's what's happening here. Likeness is another word meant to reiterate what was already said, to further inform what was already described. The word itself means a pattern, a shape, or a form of something. We see this word used most often in Ezekiel. As Ezekiel tries to describe this vision that he receives from God, we all know that vision with the wheels and many eyes and the one that none of us really want to spend too much time in because we don't get it. If you read that part, you'll see that word likeness is used often. Ezekiel 1 verses 5 to 11, it says, "And within it there were figures with the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance, they had the likeness of a man. And each of them had four faces and four wings, and their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they sparkled like the gleam of burnished bronze. And under their wings and their four sides were hands of a man. As for the faces and the wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn as they went, each went straight forward. And as for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right and the face of a bull on the left, and all four had the face of an eagle. And such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above, and each one had two touching another. Each had two touching another being, and two covering their bodies." Yeah, these are some incredible figures. They had the likeness or the shape or the form of men. And that's the point that God is making, that we are made in the image of God, in the likeness of God. We resemble God, but this isn't to say that we are like God in sameness. We are not the same as God. We are created. He is not. So though we are like him, though we bear the shape, the form, the likeness of God, we are not God, nor the same as God. Isaiah 40:18 uses the same word to make this point. To whom will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with him? Right? So, and it's in this understanding of image and likeness that we find our purpose. So to bring us all the way back around, as we've kind of explored some of these words, I hope I haven't lost you, but we're trying to understand what it is about the way that God made us that shows us our purpose, that shows us why he made us. And it's in this understanding of an image and likeness that we find that we were created to resemble God, not because we have arms and legs, but because we resemble God in who we are. I've got three ways in which we bear the image of God or resemble God. And firstly, God is a God who communicates. He spoke everything into existence. He is a God of rationality, one who thinks, one who speaks, one who is ruled by his mind, not by his emotion and instinct. And this is what we are called to emulate, to be like God, to resemble God in how we live our lives by the rule of our minds and not by our desires. We see that explicitly set out for us in Romans 8, verses 5 to 8, where it says, "For those who are according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who are according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For the mind set on the flesh is death, but the mind set on the Spirit is life and peace. Because the mind set on the flesh is hostile towards God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God, for it is not even able to do so. And those who are in the flesh are not able to please God." Right? This is what it means to follow Christ. This is what it means to be in the image of God. In which we were created to be a people not ruled by our desires, not walking according to the flesh, but ruled by our minds, walking according to the Spirit. Secondly, God is also a triune God, one in essence but three in persons, completely unified, one to the other. And we see that even in the act of creation. He did this in unity with the whole Godhead. And from that, that we see that we are like God because we are designed to be in relationship. That's why the church is so important, because we are not designed to be alone, but to resemble God by being unified in relationship to one another. That what Christ was praying for in his high priestly prayer in John 17, which we see in verses 9 to 11, where it said, I ask that on their behalf, I do not ask on behalf of the world, but of those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all things that are mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I have been glorified in them. And I am no longer in the world, and yet they themselves are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep them in your name, the name which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are. One of the main purposes of Christ was to restore unity between God and his creation, to deal with the sin that separated us. And in that word, alongside purchasing for us unity with the Father, he purchased unity with one another. As we are all purchased in one and the same Christ, we cannot ignore or neglect this unity in which we bear the image of God. Thirdly, God is also a holy God. The Bible is rife with passages in which he is unique and he is set apart, in which he is pure, in which he calls us to be as holy as he is holy. And he calls us to a standard of morality. He doesn't call the animals to the same standard. He calls us to a standard that he has given to us and us alone. We are expected to know the standard that he sets out and to live by it. Not because our morality will accomplish anything, but because it is in our morality that we bear the image of God. It is in our righteousness that we resemble God, and the world can then see God through us. 2 Corinthians 6, verses 14 to 7, verse 1 says this, "Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has a sanctuary of God with idols? For we are a sanctuary of the living God. Just as God said, I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore come out from their midst and be separate, says the Lord. And do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." This unequal yoking is so much more than just marriage, where it is most commonly used, but it is in all things. We were called to show the holiness of Christ, the righteousness of God, by having no part with the corrupted world beyond the fact that we live in it. We must interact with it, and we must evangelize to it. We shouldn't take joy or pleasure from the world, but rather find our joy and pleasure in being with God and with God's people, being apart from this world. And this is how we bear the image of God. This is how we resemble God, who himself takes no joy in sin, who cannot abide sin. And in the end, there are probably many more ways in which we resemble God, in which we bear the image or the likeness of God, but this isn't about our form. It's about the part of us that makes us different from everything else, the part that can interact with God, that bears the shared or the communicable attributes of God. It is that part of us that has made us, that is made new upon the new birth, which then segues into our second point, which I have titled Purpose and Responsibility. Starting in verse 26, the second half, though I'll read the whole verse, and we'll go right through verse 30. "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, so that they will have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that creeps on the earth. Then God said, "Behold, I have given to you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has the fruit of the tree yielding seed, it shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that creeps on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. Right off the bat, we see that man was made in the image of God, in the likeness of God, so that they will have dominion over creation. Now, we don't have a lot of business with monarchies anymore. I mean, we have the King of England, but in the end, that's all fairly meaningless to us over here in Canada. But back when this was the regular way that people were governed, if a ruler went to war or died before his heir was of age, he would assign a regent, one who would carry the authority of the realm until the heir was of age or until he returned. And that's what we are. We are regents assigned with the power to rule this realm until its actual ruler returns. We don't rule by our own whims and desires. We rule as our sovereign would have us rule. We rule always thinking about what we would want or what he would want. Sure, we have absolute freedom to use all that is his to live and to take care of what is his. But in the end, it's all his. It's not ours. And it is here that we see that bearing the image of God comes with responsibility. We are to have dominion over. And both of these words carry an interesting meaning. That word dominion means to take the bread out of the oven or to take the honey out of a beehive. That one took me a minute too. We are to rule over the hive that has the honey. Even though the bees didn't necessarily make it for us, God has so decreed that it is ours. Same with the bread in the oven. The oven didn't necessarily bake it for us, but it is still ours. We are to have dominion over this world. And this word over is used 8 times in this text alone. And God is making it clear what he intends. And it is a word showing primacy. It is meant to show who is the first in the order of things. And this isn't like we're used to in the New Testament, where the first will be last and the last will be first thing. That's what we are to one another. That's where we continue to subject ourselves to one another, right? That's where that first is last and last is first language comes from. But here in the context of the earth, in the context of creation, we are to be first, of greater value, of greater consideration than the earth, than the animals. Man was not made for the earth, but the earth was made for man. That's not a passage. I mean, I'm sure it's ringing a bell for you guys, because we'll deal with that next time I'm up here when we talk about the Sabbath. But the principle still applies. The earth was made for man. Man was made for God. And to God are all things. This is the proper order of things. We all know that we live in a world that sees mankind as a parasite, feeding off the world until we've used it up. But in reality, it isn't us who keeps the world. As God created the world, he upholds the world. But in fact, the world was created for us. And so I want us to focus in this whole passage that I read, I want us to focus in on verse 28. Now, we mentioned it in a previous sermon, but I want to see what this applies or means for us. And there in verse 28, we see it says that God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that creeps on the earth." It is in this passage that we find all of our imperatives. Now, if you remember, imperatives are commands. They're action words that are commanded. But the really interesting part is that all of these commands are couched in this first part here where God blessed them. So yes, he commanded them to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth, to subdue it, and to have dominion over it. These are all commands. But our text is making the point that God blessed them with these commands. That word blessed in the Hebrew means to bend down, to kneel, that God bent down, that God knelt down. Why would God kneel? And it makes sense when we think of people blessing God, right? We think of an example like Exodus 18, verse 10 to 12, where Jethro blesses God. He says there, so Jethro said, "Blessed be Yahweh, who delivered you from the hands of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods, for in this matter they acted presumptuously against the people." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. Right here we have an act of worship. Jethro is thanking God on behalf of the Israelites. He is worshiping him. He blesses him. He kneels before him. He sacrifices offerings to him, right? But this still doesn't help us to understand what this means in regards to God blessing us. And I think Psalm 116, 1 and 2 will help us to clarify what God is saying. And it says there, "I love Yahweh because he hears my voice and my supplications, because he has inclined his ear to me, so I shall call upon him in all my days." And here we see God incline or bend his ear to hear the prayers of the saints. We see Peter say the same thing in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 to 12. "Now to sum up, all of you be like-minded, sympathetic, brotherly, tender-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for that very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life, to love and to see good days, must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are towards the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." Peter's quoting Psalm 35, verses 15 and 16 there at the end. But his point is the same as the psalmist, that the eyes of the Lord are towards the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayers, that he hears them. It's the image of a father getting down onto his knees to hear what his little children are saying, to communicate with them face to face. When God blesses us, he bends down to give us something, to support us, to help us. His blessing is his rewarding us. So as we look at these commands, we ought to see them as gifts, as rewards, as helps in effort to bear the image of God. That's what these commands are. We see three different kinds of blessings, all in keeping with the idea of having dominion over, as we rule over the world in God's stead, as we steward what he has given us. One, we are to be fruitful, to multiply and to fill the earth, right? We are to have children. Remember, the world was created for us, not us for the world. We are meant to live here, to make space for ourselves, to grow as people, and to make more image bearers unto the Lord. Either we do this through procreation or we do this through evangelism. But all of us are actively taking dominion over the world, making more followers of Christ, more who seek to bear the image of God. Two, we are subduing the world. We are having dominion over all of the different aspects of creation, the fish, the birds, and over every living thing that creeps on the earth. Even over the plants and the beasts, everything has been given to us. That word subdue is to bring into bondage, to subjugate, to take under control, and this is an active thing. It is our activity, our task, our job that we are always about accomplishing this subduing. So in essence, this speaks to our work. This speaks to our jobs. They are a blessing, not a burden. They are how we take control of the world, how we rule over our part of creation, taking over every little corner of this world, having dominion over it to the glory of God. And three, it's all been given to us as provision for food. We are to have dominion over this world in order for us to make a living. This again points to our vocation, our jobs. We are to make a living off this world because it has been given to us in order to feed us. Sure, we may not all be planting and raising all that we eat, but through the means of our work, we can purchase all that we need to live and provide for our families so that they can continue to live and grow. In the end, God has given and provided for us. He has blessed us with these commands. We are to increase and to take dominion over the world. He has blessed us with the command to subdue the world. He has blessed us with the command to be provided for from the world. All part and parcel of the purpose that we saw back in verse 26, where we are made in the image of God so that we can have dominion over the world. That dominion is part of our purpose, to take the blessings that God has given us, the blessing of responsibility, and to obediently be about the responsibilities that He has purposed us for. It's always about the blessings of God. I mean, that's how we are even believers. The gifts of God, the promises of God, herein lies our hope, because it is the goodness of God that reminds us of our position all the while. It's why we love Him. It's what we see in 1 John chapter 5, verses 3 to 4. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome, for everything that has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the overcoming that has overcome the world, our faith. That's why His commands aren't burdensome, because they are given as a blessing. They are given as a help. When we're called to be ever more obedient, when we learn of another law that God expects of us, another standard that God expects of us, that's not how we should see it. We should see it as, there's another blessing to help me be more like Christ. If I only obey this, I so much more reflect the image of Christ. They're given as a support to help us in the work of bearing the image of God. It is just like it says in Ephesians 2, verses 8 to 10, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works so that no one may boast, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. God has prepared us for good works, for works which accomplish the purpose that God has put us on this purpose for, namely, bearing His image. Which brings us to our third point, which I titled Purpose and Reflection, found in verse 31. And God saw all that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. Depending on the reflective surface that we look in, we see the clarity of our image in better degrees or worse degrees. If you look in a spoon, you're going to see a distorted image. Same with a pond. Depending on how still it is and available light, your reflection will vary. If you try and fix your hair by a spoon or a pond, it may not look like you intended to. But if you look in your bathroom mirror, you reliably have a great reflection of yourself. That's the image we're shooting for, a reliably clear one. Not one that depends on our mood, not one that depends on whether or not I'm at work, not one that depends on our circumstances, but always bearing the image of God as intended, as prescribed, as we were called to. Here in verse 31, it's the end of the sixth day. God has now in 6 days created the whole universe. This wondrous place with such incredible things that it boggles the mind. From incredible creatures to phenomenal acts of weather to incredible vistas that confound the mind. God looks over His creation, our text says, that He saw all that He made. And that word saw means to look upon, to inspect, to examine closely. And God saw not just like He had been saying the whole time that it was good. He didn't end off saying, yeah, I think that's good enough. He looked at it closely. He inspected it, and He saw that it was very good. I mean, we understand the word very. It means exceedingly. It means in excess. It means more than just good, right? It was beyond good. Not only were the foundations good, but so was the place that He made. The place was good. Same with all that He filled it with. That was good. And now finally, having made the one for whom it was all created, it's so much more than just good. It's very good. An empty nursery can be nice, but it's very good when there's a baby in there. It's like when you put the finishing touches on a job or a project. Sure, it was functional. It worked. But now it's without blemish. You've been able to dote on it a little. It's perfect. God looks over creation and saw that it was perfect. The place was perfect, and the one for whom he built the place was exactly how he intended him to be. It was all very good. And in that declaration, we see the final element of our purpose, that when we exist in, live in, and abide in the purposes of God, bearing the image of God, fulfilling the blessed responsibilities that God has given us, we reflect God in such a way as to bring him the glory that he deserves. The closer we follow the purposes we were created for, the better of a mirror we are. The less it is clouded, the less it obstructs the image that we were made to carry. It's like it says in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 17 to 24. Therefore, this I say and testify in the Lord, that you walk no longer just as the Gentiles also walk in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their mind, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart. And they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. But you did not learn Christ this way. If indeed you heard him and were taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, to lay aside in reference to your former conduct the old man, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit, and to be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and to put on the new man, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Our very purpose is bound up in our creation. We are created in the likeness of God. And this is more than just an inherent quality about us, but that our very self testifies about God, that we look and act like God. This is what the new man is. It is in the likeness of God and has been created in righteousness and holiness. This was our original purpose, the image that we were always meant to bear, which is only more difficult now that we are sinners. Now that we have a sin nature and will always have this battle within us, we must strive all the more to live in the graces and the blessings that God has provided, putting off the old man and putting on the new man. Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 to 11 says, therefore, consider the earthly the members of your earthly body as dead to sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. On account of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. And in them you also once walked when you were living in them. But now you also lay them all aside. Wrath, anger, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you put off the old man with its evil practices and have put on the new man, who is being renewed to a full knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. A renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and free man, but Christ is all and in all. Bearing the image of God, being made in the likeness of God, means to look like God. Not physically looking a certain way, not a certain skin color, not because we all have our arms and our legs, not because we are male or female. None of these qualify us as image bearers. But rather it is the extent to which we reflect the character of God, that we bear the image of God. How obedient are we to his prescribed will? How much do we live out the mind of God that we see in this word before us today? Because depending on how much we strive after that, how much we match ourselves with what is described in Scripture, is how well we know that we are fulfilling our purpose as image bearers on the earth. I hope that's clear. I hope that makes some sense. We've been looking at what it means to bear this image of God, what it means to be in the likeness of God. And far from being something mystical and beyond comprehension, we have seen that it is both important and actually quite practical. This tells you how to get up in the morning and do your day-to-day. This tells you how you live and interact with one another. We saw in our first point the purpose of resemblance, how our bearing the image of God gives us purpose and is the reason for which we were created. We're actually here for the sole purpose of showing God, of telling of God, of reflecting God. In our second point, we saw that that purpose came with responsibility, that as God blessed us and gave us help, it was also a responsibility meant to enable us to do even better at carrying the image of God. Right? We're initially shown what it means, and then we grow in this understanding and in this obedience. Thirdly and lastly, we saw the purpose in reflection, that our purpose is only further cemented in how diligently and carefully we seek to follow God and to bear His image well. As we follow Christ, who, as Hebrews tells us, is the radiance of His glory and the exact representation of His nature and upholds all things by the word of His power, we bear the image of God. This is what it means to follow Christ. This is what it means to fulfill our created purpose. This is what it means to bear the image of God. In such a way, so that by our very lives, by our very characters, we testify to who God is and what He is like. I hope we've been encouraged by this, that we, with a greater understanding of what we were made for, that endeavors to help us and to see what God has provided us with in order to be obedient, that we, with renewed vigor, diligently seek to follow Christ, walking in His footsteps, as He was about the will of the Father. He says again and again that I came here not of my own will or my own efforts, but of the will of the Father. My food is to do the will of the Father. If we can follow with that same intention, that same perspective, that same attitude, walking in His footsteps as He was about that will, looking to reflect the image of God as best as we are able with the time and the capacity that we are given. We are not all the same. We are not all gifted the same. We are not all given the same blessings. But we are all called to that standard, to seek to follow with all of our ability, all of our heart, soul, minds, and strength. Bow with me in prayer, please. Dear Lord, as we come before You, and we once again are granted time to examine Your word, and we're shown how purposeful You were with everything that You said in there, how sufficient Your word is for every situation. I pray that You would continue to convict us of the things that we see there. Show us ever more Your standard and draw us away from comparing ourselves to one another or our own good ideas of what is holy enough or our own thinking of, I'm sure God is fine with this. Help us to then instead look into the Word and to know truly what You think and to truly see the path that You've laid out for us. Would You help us to desire to grow in obedience, to show that we love You by obeying Your commands, to see them more than just as commands. The tendency is to understand freedom as to do whatever I want, Lord, but would instead our understanding change and freedom be whatever You want? That we would understand these commands not as another rule, another law to follow, but as graces, as blessings that You have given us to help us do more of what is right and holy and true, to bear Your image all the better. I pray, Lord, that as we continue on from here, that all of our lives would be to Your glory, that we would exalt Your name in more than just word, but in all that we do, in the way that we think, in all that we love and pursue. Lord, would our whole lives be to Your glory. In Your holy name we pray. Amen.